Dr. William Davis, there was a time that you weren't a trim, fit person before you found out that you didn't do well with wheat. How much did you weigh? What were your triglycerides? What was your HDL?
Well, this goes back nearly 20 years, Shelley, and I made the critical mistake of listening to advice back then to cut the fat in my diet, because I did it, and I did it very seriously. I cut all the vegetable oils out. I cut all added cooking oils out. I cut all meat out. So I ate lots of grains, fruits, and vegetables. And by the way, this was at a time when I was jogging 5 miles a day, and I gained 30 pounds. And my good cholesterol, my HDL, dropped to 27. My triglycerides went to 350, and I became a diabetic.
Let's slow this down and say those numbers again. Those are big numbers.
Those are big, bad numbers. That's right. HDL 27, triglycerides 350, and a blood sugar of 161, well into the diabetic range.
All right. So your HDL, the good cholesterol, was way low. Your triglycerides, which are a warning sign of whether or not you're at risk for heart disease, were incredibly high. And you had a blood sugar that was high enough that you were officially considered a diabetic.
Exactly, while I was jogging 5 miles a day. So that was my first hint that there was something very wrong with what I was doing.
When you made this shift and you cut out the fats in your diet, you increased your complex carbs, you did all that food pyramid stuff of improving the amount of whole natural grain that you have in your diet. Were you the only one in the United States following this advice?
I think where you're headed with this is the whole nation has been doing this to some degree. And that is part of the big problem. That's why we have, I believe, a boom in obesity. Exploding levels of diabetes, all the same stuff that I experienced 20 years ago is occurring nationwide to an incredible degree. The curve of a number of people being added to the list as being diabetic is straight up. It's not a gradual increase in number of diabetics. It's an absolutely incredible and frightening rate of increase. And I think you're hearing these headlines.
Well, how about the rates of people being overweight?
That's right. Exactly parallels the boom in diabetes. There's more people now overweight and obese than ever before. I mean, we live at a time, Shelley, as you know, where these problems are the worst they have ever been in the history of man on Earth.
You are a preventative cardiologist. What about heart attacks and heart disease? Has the rate of that gone down?
Not really. We have less fatalities, and that's probably because of the vigorous use, and I would argue overuse, of heart procedures, because that's where I come from. That's my background. When I first entered practice, all I did was, and all I wanted to do back then, was angioplasty, stents, atherectomies, all those fancy high-tech cath lab type procedures. That's what I did from morning till night. It took me a number of years of doing that to realize how fruitless and how silly this really was. It was nothing more than a fancy Band-Aid.
When you say that that's a fancy Band-Aid, a lot of people swear by those procedures, Dr. Davis. But you're saying that in the long run, they don't prevent the next heart attack?
Absolutely not. So if you're on the verge of a heart attack, they can indeed be life-threatening. The problem is, most of my colleagues are not dispensing the advice that prevents heart attacks. They, in fact, dispense advice that dietary advice that I think creates heart disease or worsens or accelerates heart disease, and then patches it up with medication like statin drugs. So it's this really mixed bag of a little bit of good, mostly bad, that comes out of standard advice. And so it's no surprise that we have hospitals adding on $80 million wings to accommodate the demand for increased numbers of heart procedures. But that's not the best way to do things. I think the best way is to not even have the heart disease or heart attack in the first place.
Dr. Davis, let's go ahead and admit that you're a controversial figure. In your book, Wheat Belly, you describe a way to eat that is very different from the American Heart Association's way to eat. It's very different from the American Diabetes Association's way to eat. And you say it's better?
There's no question it's better. What I do in the diet is, step one, eliminate wheat. So this is not gluten avoidance for the gluten sensitive. This is wheat avoidance for everybody.
Are you saying that if somebody is gluten intolerant, because more people are understanding that, if they eat a wheat that does not have gluten in it, they're still going to have trouble because it's wheat?
That's right. There's more to this genetically altered plant called wheat than gluten. Gluten is simply a collection of proteins. in the wheat plant that can provoke immune responses, abnormal immune responses. But there's a lot more in wheat besides gluten. There's gliadins, for instance. Gliadins are proteins that cause appetite stimulation. People who eat wheat and thereby get the gliadin eat more, to the tune of about 400 calories more per day. People who eat wheat are exposed to the lectins in wheat, which cause increased intestinal permeability. That's probably the reason why people who consume wheat have more inflammatory diseases like arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma, lupus, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. There's also the unique carbohydrate in wheat called amylopectin A. So beans and rice and other forms of carbohydrate have different forms of amylopectin. The amylopectin A of wheat is uniquely and highly digestible, and that explains why two slices of whole wheat bread raise your blood sugar higher than table sugar and higher than many candy bars.
You just mentioned that if you take a piece of bread and weigh it on a weight machine like a gram counter for bread, and then you take an equal amount of sugar, table sugar, and you swallow one tablespoon of table sugar, or you swallow an equivalent weight of bread, the bread will raise your blood sugars faster?
Faster and higher.
I'll tell you what then. How about if we do a whole wheat bread instead of white bread? How about then?
It's worse. So that's the incredible fallacy being propagated by the dietary community, that somehow the whole grain is better. So the glycemic index, that's how they classify, of course, the a potential for raising blood sugar. The glycemic index of two slices of whole wheat bread is 72. The glycemic index of sucrose, table sugar, is anywhere between 59 and 65. So now, in reality, both are bad. So it's not like sugar is better than whole wheat. Both are bad. The incredible irony, of course, is that we're told that somehow the whole wheat is better for us. In fact, eat lots of it, which is a very big mistake.
Dr. Davis, you were talking about the staff of life in the United States and most European countries. You're talking about wheat, and you're telling people to cut that staff out from under themselves?
That's right, because it's not the staff of life, the Bible anyway. So the wheat we're being sold today, Shelley, is a very high-yield, genetically altered, 2-foot-tall plant. It's not the plant that everyone thinks of, the 4.5-foot, 5-foot-tall amber waves of grain. It's not that anymore. That's all long gone. It is a 2-foot-tall, high-yield plant that was conceived in the 60s and 70s in genetics labs and now virtually fills all products that are made with wheat. So the modern wheat we're sold today is genetically very distant from the wheat of the Bible, from the wheat of pre-biblical times. For instance, the wheat of the Bible is emmer wheat, which is a 28-chromosome wild-growing plant. Modern semi-dwarf wheat, that's what it's called, is a 42-chromosome plant. So they're very, very distant. So people often say that to me, I can't eliminate wheat because it's in the Bible. It is in the Bible, but it's nothing like what you're being sold today.
Well, Dr. Davis, in your book, Wheat Belly, you are taking shots at some of the great icons of all of our history. For instance, you are, in criticizing modern wheat, criticizing Norman Borlaug, who got a Nobel Prize for making that short-stemmed wheat that can grow more quickly and more easily, and you're saying that that wheat is not so good for us?
That's right. I do believe Dr. Borlaug was a noble, very serious-minded person. There's no question about that. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for developing the high-yield semi-dwarf variant. He won that in 1970. So it's not a question of his morals or his intentions, because I think they were genuine. What they were trying to do, of course, was back then there was terrible fear of population explosion and that we'd have billions of people starving by the turn of the century. Well, so they, Borlaug and others, governments, U.S. government, other governments, invest a lot of money in helping generate high-yield crops. And with wheat, they were particularly successful. So the geneticists, the agricultural geneticists, saw this strictly as a genetics issue in plants and a project to increase yield. What they didn't ask was how suitable were these changes for human consumption. Now, these changes were quite incredible. So we're not talking about subtle changes, maybe a couple inches shorter, a little bit more hardier in colder weather. We're talking about incredibly big substantial changes in the genetics of the plant. One of the, so that, like we talked about, there's a very clear-cut outward change in the appearance of this plant. It's no longer 4.5 feet tall, it's 2 feet tall. It's very stocky and thick, so it can hold up the very heavy seed head. So you can nitrate fertilize your crops very heavily, and a heavy seed head won't cause the short, stocky plant to buckle. Well, these outward changes are accompanied by very substantial internal or inward changes as well, genetically and biochemically. One of the most important changes, I think, introduced into the modern high-yield semi-dwarf strain of wheat is the increase in content and the modification of the structure of the gliadin protein, because what it has done, in effect, is make it a much more potent appetite stimulant. So this has held up study after study. People who consume wheat take in 400 calories more per day on average. People who eliminate wheat reduce calorie intake 400 calories per day, even if other calories are not restricted. In other words, there's no advice to cut calories, cut fat, smaller portion size, none of that. Just cut wheat, and overall calorie intake goes down 400 calories per day. Now, 400 calories per day times 365 days per year is 41.7 pounds per year. So it's no wonder we have a nation struggling with weight and diabetes who think that they gained 10 pounds this year, and that's awful year after year. Now, I see that as a partial success, having to fight off the weight-provoking effects of this modern thing called wheat. But the incredible thing is what happens when you take wheat out of the equation entirely. That's when you see incredible weight loss, and you see many conditions begin to unravel.
Well, if someone isn't going to eat wheat, then what do you recommend they eat instead?
It's a return to real food, Shelley. It's a return to more vegetables, raw nuts, eggs, including yolks, meats, if you eat meat, healthy oils like olive, avocados, cheese. It's a return to real food. In other words, it's a return to the way we ate to a large degree prior to the time when the U.S. government got in the business of telling us what and how to eat, because a lot of this is the fault of the official advice to cut your fat, eat more healthy whole grains. You step back and you see now the worst epidemic of diabetes and obesity ever witnessed in human history. Because the U.S. government legislated this advice by way of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans that came through the USDA and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the mid-80s.
Dr. William Davis, in your book Wheat Belly, you talk about two things then. You talk about how modern wheat is a far cry from wheat even 100 years ago, and it might not be as good for us. And you talk about how the dietary recommendations to eat more complex carbohydrates, especially in the form of grains, and to cut back on fats, hasn't been that good for us.
A very fair summary. So you, in some ways, wheat is carbohydrate. Carbohydrates are wheat, because when you talk to healthy people, so I'm not talking about 18-year-old kids who play Xbox and lay on the couch all day. I'm talking about adults who try to eat healthy, are aware of health issues, try to exercise. Ask these people what they're eating. And usually at least 75% of their carbohydrate calories are from wheat. In other words, it's not from amaranth, it's not from buckwheat, it's not from triticale. It's usually not entirely from beans, mostly wheat. And so wheat is the biggest problem among the carbohydrates, but it also has these other aspects beyond just being a benign carbohydrate, and that is the appetite-stimulating effect of the gliadin protein, the intestinal permeability problems of the lectins, the extraordinary blood sugar-raising properties of the amylopectin A unique to wheat. So in other words, it's almost as if, Shelley, I don't think this is true, but it's almost as if a bunch of mad scientists got together in a room and said, how do we create the most awful, destructive grain possible, all neatly put into one package? That is, in effect, what they've done. Not intentionally, though. It was just a series of unintentional, inadvertent blunders.
Dr. Davis, the way that you talk, I don't think that the Pillsbury Company likes you very much.
Well, that's true. So, that's right. Some of the barbs have already started. There's an organization called the Grain Foods Foundation who've been very, very aggressive. They've released press releases saying such things. They're going to discredit this message, which I would welcome because I think this conversation needs to be brought out into the open. I would love the opportunity on camera to debate their experts, but I don't think it's going to happen because I don't think they want to hear a lot of this stuff aired in public. I have debated some PhD-level nutritionists. I was surprised, Shelley, how little they knew about these issues. That is not as if they're aware of it and just didn't think they were issues. They weren't even aware that wheat had been changed to a semi-dwarf variant, that all these structural, biochemical, and genetic changes had been introduced. So this was all news to them. So it's not really a debate. It's more like a one-way street where I'm driving, I'm doing the driving.
You know, there are these subtle variations in wheat in terms of what kind of proteins are within them. But there are also big changes in wheat. The amount of carbohydrate in wheat, the amount of protein in wheat has changed as well. Do you think that that affects the health benefits or the health problems caused by wheat?
Yeah, I think there are issues that are sort of more peripheral. That is the increase in gluten content, the modest increase in carbohydrate content, and perhaps some of the processing methods. I think, though, they're probably secondary effects compared to the very basic structural and genetic changes introduced into the plant. What this tells me is that you could call it organic whole grain bread. You could call it multigrain, seven grain. You could call it sprouted wheat. You could call it sourdough fermented, lactic acid fermented dough or bread. It's all the same. In other words, whether it's a big loaf of expensive multigrain bread or whether it's a Twinkie, at its root, it's all coming from the same plant. They share all the same structural defects. They share all the same genetic patterns. They share the same amylopectin A, the same lectins, the same gliadin. In other words, yeah, there are subtle differences in B vitamin content and fiber content, but at the root of it all, it's all the same stuff.
It's all the same stuff, but you do say that if someone could find some of that Icorn bread, maybe then that they'd be better off.
I get that question a lot. How, if we accept this notion that modern wheat is the culprit, how far back do we have to go? Can we get, for instance, heritage wheat from 19th century, like the Red Fife strain? Or do we have to go back to spelt or emmer of the Bible? Or maybe even farther back to einkorn? Einkorn is the 14-chromosome plant that grew wild in the Middle East, the original granddaddy of all wheat plants. I think, you know, we don't have a lot of proof of this because there hasn't been a lot of documentation of the suitability of these things for human consumption through the centuries. But I think if we were forced to eat wheat or if we were going to eat wheat, I think it'd have to be the best choice would be the einkorn strain. That is the wild 5-foot-tall plant that still grows wild in the Middle East. I've had it myself, and if I have modern wheat, I get very ill. But I've had 2 slices of einkorn bread I made myself. And by the way, it smells and tastes like peanut butter. It's very, very different from modern bread. And I did not get sick. Nothing bad happened, which is hardly proof, of course. But it was at least a preliminary demonstration that these things are very, very different from what we're being sold today as wheat.
But you know what, Dr. Davis? From what you said, I don't think that we could use einkorn bread to feed the multitudes. It's just too hard to grow.
That's exactly right. So this is an impractical solution to suggest, and not that you can get it anyway. You can get a little bit grown in Massachusetts. There's a little bit grown in southern France, a little bit grown in patches in northern Italy, and a little bit yet still growing in the Middle East, but nothing approaching the incredible quantity being raised by modern techniques.
Well, in your household, you've mentioned that because this kind of bread is hard to find, you don't have any bagels and you don't have any muffins in your cupboards. And by doing that, what's happened to your triglyceride levels? What's happened to your weight? What's happened to your blood sugars?
I've lost all the weight, 30 pounds. My HDL now rides about 60 to 70, up from 27. My triglycerides are down from 350. They're more like 50. My blood sugar is now 84 or in that range. It runs in the 80s or so. Likewise, hemoglobin A1C, which is a long-term measure of blood sugars, is 4.8%, which is well into the normal range.
Now, is bread the only change that you've made? Did you stop eating wheat, but did everything else the same, or did you also change some other things?
think anybody hoping to have ideal overall health needs to go a little farther. So removing wheat is a big first step. You remove the appetite-stimulating effect. You remove the amylopectinase raising blood sugar. But what I don't want people to hear is take wheat out of the diet, drink Coca-Cola, and eat jelly beans. That's not smart either. So we've got to go a step farther after limiting the biggest problem in diet, wheat, and that is to limit carbohydrates. Because we live in a world where two-thirds of all adults now are obese or overweight, are diabetic or pre-diabetic, we want to unwind those patterns. Getting rid of wheat is a huge first step, but it might not be enough for many people, particularly established diabetics and pre-diabetics. So those people, I do believe, do a lot better by restricting other carbohydrates, such as sugars, oats, foods made of cornstarch, and other sources of carbohydrates, because carbohydrates are the ones that raise blood sugar, of course, most. And by definition, diabetes and prediabetes are high blood sugars. And so I see a lot of diabetes and a lot of prediabetes reverse just by doing this, cutting wheat, one, and then two, limiting other carbohydrates.
If you eliminate a lot of carbohydrates and you also cut wheat, I'll bet people don't like to come over to your house to eat.
Well, one of the things I've done, Shelley, in the book is to come up with recipes so that you can have familiar, fun dishes like cheesecake or cupcakes or muffins or cookies, but you have to reconfigure all the ingredients so that they're, one, wheat-free and little to no carbohydrate. So I had, for breakfast this morning, I had a carrot muffin. This weekend I made my chocolate almond biscotti. I dipped that in my coffee. And I also baked a carrot cake. So you can have these things in addition to your vegetables, nuts, and meats, and eggs, and cheese, and the real food. It's nice to have an occasional indulgence, but not pay a health price for it. And so that's what I did in the book as well. I tried to provide recipes to allow people to do just that.